Hare Krishna. So, in the speaking part, you'll see from your handout that some advice on how to deliver your talk is being offered. This is one small point. Don't tolerate distractions that you don't need. Like this stuff. You're speaking about one thing and people are reading about another. When you get up to speak, try to avoid clutter. The place where you speak should be set up in such a way that people's attention is naturally focused on you, on the speaker, and not on clocks right above your head or janitors adjusting something on the side or people coming in and out. No. Okay. Some more points. Get enough rest. That's not usually a problem for devotees because we're accustomed to getting enough rest or operating on very little. But try to get enough rest so that you can function. Don't be so rarefied that you can't think when you have to speak. Eat sparingly before you speak. How many devotees are aware of the importance of this principle? Let's see a show of hands. Okay. Good. If you're not aware of it, this one piece of advice is worth the whole price of the course. It really is. It makes such a tremendous difference, and the professionals also point it out. There's one videotape of some debate, and one of the devotees has his face all contorted, and obviously it's because he's eaten fairly recently before the engagement. So that his digestion is completely taking his attention, or it's controlling him. It's distracting him. Don't let your digestion compete with your intelligence. Have a clear mind. It's so valuable. It's such a valuable instruction. I was feeling it, and I was trying to observe the principle as much as possible. And then when I read it in the professional advice, then I became just completely convinced. Before you have a class to give or some big engagement to do, just skip it. Skip eating. Take some juice, take a little fruit. And after you deliver your talk, enjoy. That's all right. And if there are engagements, also, because the audience, same principle applies to the audience, an improperly arranged engagement is set up in such a way that the audience eats after the talk. Now, sometimes in Western business circles it's set up the opposite way. But usually, especially when it's expected that the speaker will say something important, it's set up in that order. Or in our case, there'd be kirtan, there's the talk, there's more kirtan, then there's the prasadam. Not the other way around. Otherwise, people are working on the prasadam when their brains should be working. Dress nicely. Srila Prabhupada liked it. There's one story Hari Sari told me, that Prabhupada saw him one time when Hari Sari was Prabhupada's secretary. Hari Sari dressed all in silk and shaved head. Also, it was very nice. We don't want to become a society of silk merchants. Well, how much did that one cost you? Well, I got mine here or there. But if we dress nicely for the sake of preaching, that's more than approved. Crowd the audience together. There are two ways that you can do this. If you're in a big room and people are all spread out, as they'll tend to be, you can ask them, come up forward. Better, if you're expecting a small audience in a big place, tape off the extra seats. Either take them out or rope them off so that people have no alternative but to sit up close. Because if you have to ask them, then I was all sitting here. They don't like being disturbed. And if more people come than expected, you can always open up a few extra rows. But there's a certain togetherness of the audience makes it possible for you to address them in the mentality of a group. so that they respond as a group, you can address them as a group. Otherwise, each person's in his own world. It makes it much more difficult to do. Our Hansa Dutta used to tell me that Hitler and the Nazis followed this principle very intelligently. If they had a program to give, they'd always hire a smaller hall so that it would be packed. They wouldn't have a big hall half empty. Better to have your people packed together, not only so you make a good show, but so that you've got a group, a coherent group to address. Yes?
This is another point. I don't know. Sometimes, especially when people are westernized, which is a lot of people we speak to, they're not accustomed to sitting on the floor, and they feel very uncomfortable.
Srila Prabhupada therefore wanted that in Los Angeles, the room which is now the temple room should be a lecture hall with seats. He wanted that was the original idea that he had when we first got 3764. That one room should be the temple and the other room should be a lecture hall so that ladies and gentlemen could sit and hear the lectures.
That's the way it was.
Was that originally how it was?
That was the way it was. They had church pews and lectures. And where the Faith Museum was a very nice temple.
That's where the temple was. Then they were pushing that we really want to have a big temple and so on. But it wasn't Prabhupada's original desire. So yes, if you can make arrangements, if you're expecting that kind of audience, and you want to make arrangements for chairs, there's no objection.
Even if you had big
cushions? Yes. That's actually, in a properly arranged engagement, that's one of the principles, that there's a seat not only for the speaker, but for the audience also. They'll have some sort of seats according to who they are and what their cultural background is. It'll either be chairs, or it'll be, you know, chattai like this, or some sort of, or even on padayatra, some tari would be there, some, you know, those canvas.
Also, the speaker should sit higher than the audience, or on an equal level, but
Depends. Some auditoriums are arranged in such a way that people are looking down on the speaker. But the main point is that he should be the focus of attention. That's the point. He should be the focus of attention. Now, if you do find yourself in a small room with a small group of people, then simply change the way that you give the talk. Maybe you even want to, you know, pull up a chair backwards and sit on it, depending on what kind of atmosphere you want to create. You can make it very informal. You were expecting 50 people, 5 people came. Don't give your 50 people talk. Sit down and talk to who actually is there. Keep the air fresh. This applies to our Bhagavatam classes as well as other engagements. Open the windows, open the doors, get the fresh air in there. If it's all claustrophobic, people will sleep. There's some story, some big speaker used to have his guy throw a chair or something through the window and break it apart if he was going to give an engagement, rather than speak in some claustrophobic room with no air. Lights, there should be lights. People want to see your face. If you're setting up an engagement, arrange for proper lighting. Step up to speak with confidence. Yes, question.
In regards to the lights, is it better that when a speaker speaks, there's lights on the audience or
not? That's a question of choice. I don't know the psychology, what they say. But at least you should be lit. That's the point. When you step up to speak, you're beginning the impression that you create on the audience. So don't shrink up, amanena manadena, like the Babajis that Maharaj was talking about. Well, I don't really deserve to be here, but step up to speak. You have something to say when it's your time to speak, and you should stand up strongly like a man and get ready to say your piece. Not too much humility, please. Get set before you speak. Don't rush into it. If I've got 7 things, 10 things to set up here, I'd rather spend the extra time, set them up, have everything in its place, and when I know that I'm set, then I'm ready to speak. Not that while I'm speaking, I'm still trying to figure out how the microphone works, whether this is going to be right, whether that's going to be right. Better that at the beginning, you make sure that you're completely set, and even take an extra few seconds to look around and make sure that everything is the way it should be. And the audience is not bored. They're using that time also. They're thinking about, they're getting set. They're mentally preparing themselves for what you're going to say. So the time will be well used. Don't worry. Then, after you're set, you take a moment to establish contact with people. You're set. You're ready. Then, there's an audience out there. So you acknowledge that. You see who's there. You look at them. You try and establish some rapport, because it's a communication. If you're introduced to a person, you don't just go, "Oh, pleased to meet you." Establish some rapport, some communication. Even if it might be a smile, or it might be at least a look. Then you're ready to speak. Not that you've got your notes in your hand, you're intent on them, you're ready to go. No, the audience should be acknowledged. Maintain an appropriate posture. Very difficult for some of us who grew up for 15 or 18 years hunch-shouldered. But as far as possible, if you can be conscious of your posture, that also has a good deal to do with what people think of you. Amazingly. Amazingly. I'm not the person to give this advice, but try for it. Avoid grunts. This advice is needed. Grunts. Well, no, avoid it. Those are grunts. They're all thinking noises. Time wasters. Meaningless sounds. They don't do anything for your message. Doesn't do anything for you. It's a habit, and it's a bad one. And when it's particularly bad, you really notice it. But if you watch television and see the newspaper, the journalists, they don't punctuate their speeches with ahs and sos and wells and hmms, all sorts of little noises. The best of them, when they're between thoughts, simply maintain silence. If you're thinking, just take the time and be quiet. Now I'm ready for my next thought. Which is better? A little bridge made of ahs and sos and wells and hmms, or just a moment of silence? That moment of silence is actually effective. They've been digesting what you've been saying. You've been hitting them with words. Probably you ended your last sentence with something strong. We hope so, anyway. Give them a moment to think about it.
Also, I see a bunch of clearing the throat all the time.
That's another one. All of these little nervous vocal habits, the you knows and the wells, you know is the worst. Or it's the most prevalent these days. It seems to have taken over America. You know. So you know what I mean? If you've spoken clearly, they will know what you mean. And if you're just quiet and look to see if they've understood what you mean, that's much better than just punctuation marks. You know, well, so, huh? Practice it. It just takes practice. And it's very hard. You'll never purge all of them from your speech. The ums and you knows and wells and sos will still come in there. But at least if you're working on it, you can reduce the proportion. In some people's talks, if you took a count, you'd probably find it was 10 to 20%. Wells, us, mms, you knows. Try and cut them down, if possible, to nil. Yes?
Well,
Would you put the expression kind of or sort of in the same category?
I might, depends. There's a little bit of a different category. Yes?
I notice some people do have that habit. How can they practice freeing themselves?
By constant practice and determination.
Oh, Arjun.
No other way. Make a tape recording of one of your lectures and listen to it. It's practice. It's only practice. It can be done. First step is just to be aware of it. To understand, I'm doing it and it's not good. Just like this vocabulary stuff that we're talking about. First thing is we have to know what we're doing. Then we can start catching ourselves. Like biting your nails. Or I remember when we first came to ISKCON, we always used to have the habit of touching our mouths with our hands. Because in the West, you do it, you know, you put your hand. And then gradually you're told again and again and again, you can't do that. You did it again, go wash your hands. Finally, you learn. Right? It's not hopeless. Another question? Okay. Gesture, we discussed that yesterday, but don't fidget. It's the most disturbing thing in the world when someone has a habit of doing something that's, you know, yeah, pulling this. There's a lot of them, a lot of different gestures that people have, different ways of fidgeting. If you have to do something, then make a deal with your subconscious to trade down to something invisible. Press your forefinger into your thumb behind at your side, or put your hands behind your back, and dig into your wrists with your nail. Something that people won't see. I know I have one godbrother who was, he had this. He used to really do this all the time when he'd speak. He doesn't do it anymore. But it's very distracting. Very distracting. It generally happens with the hands. It can be with, yeah, they're with the knees also, some people. Generally it's the hands, it's something nervous. So just really try to control that. Best by thinking about something good to do with your hands. Use them. They will distract like anything if you fidget. Don't be disturbed by your errors. Everyone makes them. If you find that you're tripping up on your words, if you said something you didn't mean to say, it's not quite right, just go right on speaking. Or if it's something significant enough to correct, excuse me, I mean this, and keep going. Don't get all embarrassed. Don't apologize. Don't get confused. But another thing you can do, and you'll see the professionals also do this, if you find that you're tripping on your words, just slow down a little bit. It's a sign that you're going faster than you can actually go. So if you find yourself tripping up, start slowing down. Slow down. Give yourself a chance. You won't have the problem. But don't call attention to your errors. Just keep going. When you're finished, speak then same way you walked on, confidently. Walk off, don't slink off. And most important of all, speak loudly enough. Please speak loudly enough. Whether you're giving the speech, whether you're asking a question of the speaker, whether you're addressing some group just with a one-off point or whatever it is, if you're speaking, speak. If you want to say something, say it. Don't feel that I have to half say it. Don't be embarrassed. Don't be amanina manadena in that sense. You know, so humble that you speak, but you don't really speak. Speak out. Dhruva has a great voice. When he gets up to give an announcement, when he gives a class, when he says anything, he immediately has your attention because he has that big, loud voice and he's not afraid to use it. And most of us also have big, loud voices, but we just have to find them. Okay? Yes.
Is it okay to ask the audience if they can hear you?
Sure. Is it all right to ask the audience? Is it all right to ask the audience? Can you hear me? It's definitely all right. Can you hear me in the back?
Yes.
Now can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure, it's definitely all right. It's quite fun. Yes.
Mara, I've got one question which is also in relationship to yesterday's class.
Okay.
You said that we shouldn't change our voice when we're speaking.
Yes.
However, I've noticed some devotees tend to at least slow down their speaking a bit. And it seems to have a kind of more, it avoids this error of going too quickly over the points and not developing them. Is that all right?
Yes. You may also want to slow down your ordinary speaking voice. You may find that when you talk to people, you just talk so fast that they can't follow what you're saying anyway, and they're just exasperated by talking to you. So be conscious of how you're speaking. The idea is not to have an artificial or rhetorical voice, or a voice that's stilted, that has a kind of a sing-song effect. Up and down, like clippity-clop of a horse. It's not effective. In normal speech, we emphasize what we want to emphasize. We run over quickly points that we want to dispense with quickly. We stop on some words and let them sink in. We drive home some point. So in that natural way, we want to speak only louder, a little amplified, because we're trying to talk to 50 people. If I'm talking to one person, I talk to one way, talk to them one way. Five people, it's a little bigger. You guys, you've got to understand this. I'm talking to 10 people, and if you're talking to 100 or 1,000, again, it's just made larger. But it's the same person who'd be speaking to one person. And in fact, radio commentators and television commentators are trained like that. They're trained to have in their mind one person. When you speak on the radio, you're speaking to one person, not 1,000. Because each person who's hearing you is only one person. He's not 1,000 people, and he doesn't want to be spoken to like 1,000 people. He wants to be spoken to like the one person that he is. So he wants to hear your natural voice, but loud and expressive. Okay. Now, to get on some English pronunciation errors. I think we touched on them on the topic briefly. Devotee is hopeless. It's already established. There's nothing you can do about it. Devotee. I'm not going to try and change it. It's solid in there. But at least you should know that the commonly understood pronunciation of the word is devotee. At least know it. And sometimes you may want to use it, especially if you're talking to a sophisticated audience. Yes. The proper English pronunciation of the word devotee is, here's even the division of it. We divide it this way. Right? Devotee. Actual word is dev-o-t. Yes.
In Webster's, it includes these kind of pronunciation.
The latest, which Webster's?
Well, I've got one. Collegiate.
Show it. Ninth Collegiate?
I don't know what to...
Okay. I want to see this one because it's new. The last collegiate I looked in, Webster's 8th, didn't have it. They have devotee or devotee, which is also false. It assumes that it's a French word, which it's not. So if you say devotee, you're at least almost as well off as those who say devotee with a false air of being cultured with their French pronunciation. It doesn't come from any French word. There's no such... In fact, the French devotees had a problem finding a translation of our English word devotee. They use pakta because there is no French word devotee. Devotee, it's false. Anyway, say whichever one you want, but know which one's what. Herb, H-E-R-B. No initial H in the pronunciation. I don't know British usage, forgive me.
You use the H.
You use the H. If you're outside of Britain, if you're American, American pronunciation is herb. What else? Illusory. No. There's no such word. Illusory energy. It's an illusion. The word you want is illusory. Okay? It's embarrassing to hear illusory.
Illusory and the other false pronunciation.
Illusory. 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 It's a four-syllable word. No more.
It has to be S. It's not illusory.
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 Illusory. Yes.
Deity.
Either one. You can. Either one's all right, as far as I know. I think they may have deity also. No, spelling is another question. We are not dealing with spelling in this course. You can say deity, as far as I know. Or deity. The regional variation is allowed in that word. Mischievous. No. Don't let that I creep in there. It's a three-syllable word. Mischievous. Mischievous, not mischievous. The demons are mischievous. No. Mischievous. One more. Perfect. Pardon me. Perfect is a verb. Perfect your life. If you want an adjective, when you perfect your life will become perfect. Srila Prabhupada used this for both. He's allowed. You're not. Okay? This will all be on handouts for you later.
Is it okay to say humbleness of it instead of humility?
Yes, they're both legitimate words. Any more English pronunciation questions while we're here?
Is it heinous or heinous?
Heinous. And how do you pronounce? Either one. Obeisances or obeisances?
Dynasty,
I've never seen. Dynasty may be regional. Look in your dictionary. How do you pronounce this? Yes. Scion. Nescience, not nescience or nescience. I think so. Check your dictionary. Obeisances is definitely safe. Heinous. Check your dictionary again.
Different dictionaries.
You have to see. Sometimes there's more than one way to say it. Scion. Yes.
Diminution, not diminution.
Yeah, whatever it is. Diminution.
Is advantageous a word?
Yes. Advantageous is a good word. Yes.
Lineage.
Perfectly good.
Inefficient.
Neo-ficient?
Munificent.
Munificent. Perfectly good word. Munificent. Any others?
Duplicious.
What?
Duplicious,
duplicious, yes. Don't be duplicious. There's no such thing. duplicitous. Use the dictionary. If you don't know, if you're unsure, don't go on making yourself look silly or uneducated to people who know better. Don't just choose the pronunciation that sounds more learned to you. That's another way to make yourself look silly, is to try to be a upper. Look in the dictionary and see what's accepted. If there's a choice, do what suits you. Yes?
I've noticed that Webster's Dictionary will give pronunciation in different countries.
Srila Prabhupada used to say Neshayas. The standard pronunciation is Neshas. The standard pronunciation for all such and such of Bharata is Sayan. Oh, Sayan of Bharata. Most of us also don't know what it means. It means descendant. Which is also an easier thing to say. But, because it's there and you'll be called upon to read it sometimes, read it right. Oh, Sayan of Bharata. Yes?
You're mentioning Bharata so many times, Sanskrit words with an A.
Oh, we're going to get into Sanskrit too. That's another category of mispronunciation. We'll start with English. Then this word perfect. Perfect and perfect are both good words in English, but they're different words. Perfect is an adjective. Perfect is a verb. Chant Hare Krishna and perfect your life. None of us would say perfect your life. Perfect your life. And when your life has thus been made successful, it will not be perfect. It will be perfect.
Do you know the difference? Are they both written the same way? Are they both words?
They're written the same way. They're spelled the same way. They're practically the same word. But when you use it as a verb, you want perfect. When you use it as an adjective, you want perfect. Everybody used to say perfect as an adjective. But Prabhupada said perfect. This Krishna consciousness movement is perfect. So we all say perfect. But it's not standard. One other final word of advice. Just about out of time. Final word of advice. If you have doubts about the pronunciation of a word or the meaning of a word, there's one book I commend to you most highly, the dictionary. Get yourself a good standard English dictionary. Those of you who are from Great Britain, get yourself a British dictionary with British pronunciation. Americans, get yourself an American dictionary. The rest of you, choose as you like. American or British, as you prefer. Probably Indians would prefer British pronunciation. And look it up when you have a question. Very helpful book. Yes?
I might say it wrong.
Inebriety, as far as I know.
And is it a... What type of word is it?
It's a noun. It means drunk. Actually, inebriated means intoxicated.
But what if someone says, there are many inebrieties in this society?
It means that we're not sober.
So there's a state of inebriety, and then there are specific
inebrieties. Yes. Yes. You can look up, use your dictionary, it's a great book. All these subtle distinctions will be clarified for you. Every temple should have such a book. People who write letters, people who have to publish things, anybody who has to speak or communicate, use a dictionary from time to time. Very good.
Also different words for demoniac and demonic.
Yeah, this distinction is so subtle that you more or less can forget about it. But the preferable word for the for our purposes, demoniac nature, is demonic. It's slightly preferable, but you can use either one without impunity. You don't have to worry about it.
One is lighter than the other.
No, there's another kind of distinction. It's not even worth getting into. You can look in the dictionary and try to figure it out. It's so subtle that it's not really worth your time. You can use either one and not get stuck. Okay. If you come across some other words that are routinely mispronounced in English by our devotees, you can bring them to my attention as worthy of mention. Maybe they'll take a place on our rogues list. Okay, topic switching. You're going along in an argument, making your points, and your opposer is making his points, and you're going on and going on, and all of a sudden you have this lost feeling. You don't know where you are. And your opposer is saying something. You don't really understand how it got there, but you assume that he must be knowing what he's talking about, so you nod your head and just follow right along with what he's saying. But you fail to realize that he has switched the topic. You figure, I must be an idiot or something. I must have been sleeping. I must have missed something. Therefore, I'm not following. It's my mistake. So you just follow right along, picking up where you figure you must have left off, and let him lead you wherever he wants. Don't do that. If you feel lost, if your instincts tell you, I don't know where, how did we get here? There's a reason. The reason may be that you've been sleeping, that you weren't listening, that your opposer has been saying something personally, perfectly reasonable, perfectly in line, and you failed to see it. If that's so, you owe it to him and to yourself to find out what happened, to find out where you missed. In that case, say, wait a second, I didn't follow. How did we get here? I didn't follow your logic there. Could you go over that again? More likely what's happened is that he simply switched the topic. That you started out talking about how we need new mridangas for the kirtan party, and now we're talking about how mridangas are better when you get them from Navadvip than when you get them from Vrindavan. And therefore, really, the blue ones with the little band around them are the ones that we want. Not this. And we forgot all about the fact that what we were talking about was whether we were going to order three or whether we were going to order seven. Any kind of conversation can go that way. You start off talking about one thing, and the topic switches, it changes. Particularly when you're getting somewhere. Particularly when you're getting somewhere. We'll bring up an example. We have a couple of people I know who are famous for it. It's their stock in trade. It's the way that they successfully pull off winning arguments. As soon as they get in a jam, they switch the topic. They just blatantly, shamelessly, boldly switch on to some entirely different matter and bully you into going along with them. And the only way to deal with them is to say, wait a second. That's not what we're talking about. That's not what we're talking about. Diversion, changing the subject, red herring. It's said that if you pull a red herring in the trail, in the course of a bloodhound, he loses the scent of the trail. You set him off course. That's what we're talking about. Changing the subject, disproving a minor point. We base this on the authority of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which says in the 10th canto, 4th chapter, 5th verse, such and such and such and such. This verse proves such and such conclusion.
pardon me, but it seems to me that it was verse number 3, not verse number 4. So what? Don't get diverted. Fine, okay, it was verse whatever you want. The important thing is, Krishna says such and such. Don't let yourself be thrown off by disproving of a minor point. Avoiding the question, you ask a question and the person tells you something completely irrelevant, answering some other point, don't be afraid. That's not what I wanted to know. That's not the point at issue. That's not what we're talking about. Okay. Inserting a new argument, usually an argument about someone's character, and then pretty soon, that's the kind of argument that pretty soon devolves into a bickering squabble. Don't be dragged into that. Such and such person is this or that or this or that. That's besides the point. Is what he said true? That's what we're talking about. Then, substituting and defending a more moderate argument. That happens all the time. You start off with the most extreme position just to grab everybody's attention and get everybody's feathers up. You start off with an extreme statement, and as soon as your statement is contradicted or counteracted by a reasonably stated opposing statement, you just go right along with that opposing statement, you just back off a little. You can back off as far as you want. You can weave in and out, and dodge and move and cheat like that. Then, so then I understand that you don't really defend your original statement after all, am I correct? Originally you stated that every person who doesn't accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead must be a demon. And now you're saying that either he's a demon or he's innocent and uninformed. Am I correct? Now you have to choose what position are you actually defending? Very common technique. That way, that technique gives you the best of both worlds when you use it, this fallacy. You get a lot of attention at the beginning by a real heavy assertion, and you win at the end because your final assertion is a real mild, reasonable one. But you obscure the point that you shifted your positions. Okay? Don't let people get away with that. So the key to all this is to listen. That was our first rule a few days ago. You have to listen to what people are saying. And when they switch the topic, you'll know it. If you're not listening, when they switch, you won't know. First thing is you have to listen. Second thing is, again a point we made a few days ago, you have to know what the argument is about. What is your position and what is his position? If you don't know what you're arguing about, if you don't know what the topic is, when someone switches the topic, you will know the difference. Keep your eyes on the ball. Srila Prabhupada was expert at not letting people get away with topic switching. In Krishna consciousness, I find in my personal preaching that this is the usual fallacy that we'll come across most often. You make a point, and you're making progress on the point, you're sewing it up, you're closing in, and the person just says, yeah, well, another thing I wanted to know. Am I right? Another thing I wanted to know. Or perhaps you could tell me, well, okay, aside from that, another thing, don't let them do it. Srila Prabhupada was expert. I used to think a little bit, you know, why is Prabhupada so, I was a little offensive almost, you know, thinking that, like, Prabhupada didn't maybe you know, it was just something I didn't understand, or I just couldn't understand why Prabhupada would just come back and back and back and back to the same point again and again and again. As if, you know, almost as if he couldn't lack flexibility or something. Actually, Prabhupada is the person who exactly knows how to deal with an argument. Everybody always wants to switch the topic, and Prabhupada doesn't let them do it. When he wants to talk about you're not this body, no one's going to talk about anything else. Because he's not going to let the topic be switched. I remember a talk with a Newsday reporter in New York. You know that talk about? Pounding bricks, right? Prabhupada's making a point. And every time the reporter wants to change it to something else, Prabhupada just goes right back to his original point. And the man is getting frustrated. Many times, yes, your grace, but what I wanted to know is Prabhupada refuses to change the subject. He has something he wanted to say, and until that point is understood, he's not going to change. So I've given you some formulas. How Prabhupada would refuse. I'll give an example. Oh, I'll give a few examples. One is, how many of you have heard Srila Prabhupada arguing with Christians? What's his method? Thou shalt not kill. Then what's their response? Their usual response is to go on to some other topic.
The most important is to love God.
They have so many things. There's so many things. But eventually, once Prabhupada gets heavy on this topic and really starts stressing it, they want out. They want out. They want to go to any other topic under the sun than this one. And Srila Prabhupada, what does he do? Doesn't give him an inch. He just keeps hammering at that point. There's no value in changing the topic. We've got the topic, we've got the point, we know what the problem is, and we're not going to budge. There's no use talking about higher subject matters until you give up your barbarian practice of killing innocent living beings. How can we talk higher philosophy with murderers? The Prabhupada doesn't budge from the point. Here's another kind of example. Srila Prabhupada says, so my point is that there must be a supreme controller. And then the guest says, yes, but why must that supreme controller be Krishna? Then how do we respond? We say, well, it must be Krishna because of this and this and this and this, because Krishna's, right? Wrong. How do we respond?
That is another question.
Yes. Or?
Call Krishna,
whatever you call him.
Or? A very typical Prabhupada response is, whether Krishna is the supreme controller, that we can discuss later. It may be whoever it may be. That lends Prabhupada's argument fantastic flexibility. Everybody thinks that they're going to, you know, get it. They're one step ahead of the argument. Oh, I see where you're going. There's a supreme controller, then the supreme controller's got to be Krishna, then I've got to surrender to Krishna. Uh-uh. But Prabhupada refuses to go ahead of the argument that way. First point is that there must be a supreme controller. Yes, but why must it be Krishna? And maybe Krishna or maybe some other person that we can talk about later. First thing is there must be a supreme controller. Because until that point is settled, there's no use talking about who it might be. And once the point is settled, it's going to be real easy to get to the next point. So don't let the topic be switched. Not backwards, not forwards, not to the sides. Another way the Prabhupada would argue, same thing. Prabhupada is arguing, so there must be some process for self-realization. We have to follow a process. And again they say, yes, but why must that process be Krishna consciousness? Whether that process is Krishna consciousness or something else, there must be some process. Go back to the point again. Question? Yes?
Can both slokas for the new people, asking from the 5th person about who is Krishna, if you go some Sanskrit slokas.
Is that the topic you want to talk about?
Yeah. If some people say that who is Krishna, if you report some Sanskrit slokas, that
Sanskrit slokas are fine, but you've switched the topic. What I'm talking about is not how you give evidence. I'm not talking about how you give evidence for a point. I'm talking about how you stick on the point that you want to talk about. I'm talking about sticking to the point. And you're talking about how do you prove the point that you're sticking to. You've changed the topic. Do you understand that? You're changing the topic. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is that in a discussion, if we're talking about a specific topic, we shouldn't change and talk about some other topic. Do you follow what I'm saying? Okay, he gives in. That's what I mean. Yes.
Is the fact, Maharaj, that if you're going to stick to that one particular topic, the other person raises up another topic which you say we can put aside for now, and then you finally do convince them of that one particular point, then you've got to have more or less a set plan in order to lead him to the obvious conclusion you were originally going to tell him to probably recognize.
Well, it may be a set plan or not a set plan, but generally when you have an argument, you do have a plan in mind. Am I right? So once you settle topic A, you can go to topic B. You may have a topic B in mind, or you may be open. What's your next question? You're ready to take any question. But once he brings forward his question, you're not going to get off that question and on to some other question and deal with a barrage of questions and not really come to a conclusion on any of them. So whether it's your plan or his plan, once the topic is settled upon, let's stick to the topic and reach a conclusion. Not inconclusive. Any topic, followed to its proper conclusion, will result in surrender to Krishna. When you follow any topic to its logical conclusion, the conclusion is surrender to Krishna. First chapter, second chapter, tenth chapter, Bhagavatam, Vedas, doesn't matter. So take a topic and stick to it. Another point.
In which moment you can change the topic?
You can change the topic anytime you want. You can also play the game too. Any of these dirty tricks that we're talking about, you can also use. But beware. We're encouraging straight, clean thinking. Already, even without knowing these different devices, we're accustomed to using them. Second nature. I know one person who used to win arguments this way. You'd be talking about something and making your points very plain and clear. And someplace when you were really getting somewhere, he said, yes. He'd say, yes. But that's a detail. We're talking about principles. And you can't sacrifice the principle for the details. Then, regardless of what you were talking about, you'd have to be thinking, well, is that true? Okay, is it right to sacrifice principles for details? It was so effective. He just pulled it out at the right time. And there you'd be, wondering about whether or not he was right about the principles and whatever you were arguing about, however good it was. Lost. He'd just throw you. There was a perfect red herring right across the trail. The bloodhounds would all look up and go. Don't fall for it. Another question.
Yes, how can we throw back the ball to such a red herring?
Just bring it right back to the topic. Well, that's not what we're talking about. Just know what you're talking about and bring it back to what we're talking about. Yes?
In a situation where, say, a person starts out with a very
very strong thing in the beginning.
Well, the different strategies you can use, but one is, so you're no longer defending your original point, am I right? So you accept my point that such and such thing that you were saying is unacceptable, am I right? Make him identify himself. Who is he standing up for? No topic switching.
Oftentimes those statements that are so strong and emotional are similarly they're just kind of based in sort of this system of absolute skepticism and absolute positivism. In other words, it's just like one way or the other.
Usually strong statements that are so bold and shocking are statements that are not strong but weak. Their factual basis is weak. Their emotional power may be strong, but when the argument is examined, it starts to fall apart. Therefore, examine.
Isn't it that sometimes hammering the point over may give a weak person a very bad feeling, and because he's less intelligent, he'll just leave you with this bad feeling. Whereas if you're more flexible with him, you won't hammer the point, you will go along
I understand your point. That's another of our early rules, don't be obnoxious. And another point we made in the very introduction, and that is that we're not just out to win arguments. We're out to give people Krishna consciousness. So yes, you may hammer away at someone and hammer him apart, or hammer him away. So you can consider that. But when it comes to a question of actually deciding some point, when there's something to be resolved, some argument, some question to be decided, you should have a clear understanding in your mind what you're talking about and not get lost, diverted, switched. When you say that the temple shouldn't have to pay or shouldn't have to pay for the maintenance of grihasthas, that it's against the Vedic principles, don't get involved in this. When he says, don't get lost when he says, yes, but we only have 7 grihasthas and they're living on very small salaries. That's not your point, is it? It's completely aside from your point. Your point is that it's against the Vedic principles. That it really doesn't matter whether they're 7 or 15. It doesn't really matter whether they're getting $100 a week or 100 rupees a week. If it's against the Vedic principles, it's against the Vedic principles. Do you agree? My point is that it's against the Vedic principles. And I've given 10 examples. Now, do you accept it or not? How many grihasthas there are, how much they cost, how humble they are, what good devotees they are, that's irrelevant. My point at the moment is that it's against the Vedic principles. Now, once you agree to that, you may still come back and say, yes, it is against the Vedic principles, but we have to adjust the Vedic principles according to time, place, and circumstance. That's a further argument, which can be brought up and countered and so on. But first thing is, this is the topic at hand. Then once we've decided this question, we can go on to another question. But when we're talking about whether or not it's a Vedic principle, and you bring up how many people are or are not following,